I want to express my appreciation for to those people who've arranged the opportunity for me to be here to share some of these things with you. And I feel after our supper, I met some of the people just eating together, some of the students and so forth, and I feel much closer now, because if I would have come just straight like this, it would have been a little difficult. I'm aware that the whole lecture series was under the heading of values, you know, so to speak. So we touch values in these ways, and then you bring in these speakers, and then they do their thing. But then maybe you are asked to magically connect them to values. Well, what I did to try to help is that I have devised a strategy here to present to you some thoughts about values first. Let's say maybe I'll take about 15, 20 minutes or so talking a little bit about my thoughts about values. And then after that, I want to cite to you some historical things, some things that have happened in history to Indians. And then I would follow that up with some description of what I'm doing now and the kinds of structures I work with now. And then I would finally end up with some questions perhaps relating to issues, maybe, or today's realities. Now, as I understand it too, some of you might like to talk to some of these issues, or you may have questions of your own which are very important. I'd like to just talk to you like this, you know, at that time. I'm just not at all hung up about doing these things even now. See, if you had a question and you wanted to elaborate a little bit, just raise your hand a little bit, and I'd be glad to talk to you a little bit about the matter. You know, in any case, I hope to be informative and perhaps feel a little bit closer to you through this process. You know. Okay, first of all, I want to share with you some ideas that I have about Indian values. And perhaps I can start by saying that there are three things that seem to be very important, three areas that seem to be very important when you're talking about Indian values. One is represented by the word spirit. Then the second is represented by the word family. And the third is represented by the word environment. These are kind of basic areas where that I'd like to relate to. Out of these three words come the values. See, for the spirit base, we have the value of life attitude and time. For the family base, we have perhaps the attitudes of age, individualism, and sharing. And for the environment base, we have the word balance. Okay. Now what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is I'd like to put these on the board. And so I'll just pause a moment or so here while I do this and hope that this will be helpful to communicate. I like to think that in the beginning, when man was made, that there were really three kinds of realities. In the beginning was God. You probably heard that someplace. I think that really that's a reality for all people. The second thing, in the beginning was family, obviously. See, and they had children upon children. The third thing, obviously, you were put in an environment. Okay? So even today, we have Indian values based on those three areas. Now, I happened to get into the field of social work. And I thought it was rather interesting to review social work values. And just for your comparison, I want to write down social work values. In the first place, the areas that social work concentrates on is myself and others. Okay, so much for the areas. And then the three very important things relates to justice, responsibility, mental health, and then the five great points, positive relationships with others, cooperation in a framework of competition, and individual initiative in the framework of cooperation, and freedom of participation, which includes the freedom to make decisions about yourself, and finally, individualization in a group, which is different from a mob or a crowd. And once again, I'd like to write these on the board, and I'd like to show you some interesting comparisons. When I looked at those, I began to understand some things. Because it looks as though social workers, perhaps, and maybe others, I don't know who social workers are, but I think social workers are those who are concerned about others. See? We talk about values. One of my values is justice. I feel that, you know, I ought to have justice. I think you ought to have justice. I think we ought to have justice. Responsibility. I feel responsible for you. I feel you should feel responsible to me. Responsibility for each other. If you find me in a group, help me to be an individual. And also help me to be a member of the group. Mental health. I have to feel inner satisfaction. I have to feel that inside me. I have to be able to express this confidently. If I'm able to do that and feel that way, perhaps I have mental health. I have to have positive relationships with others. Not negative relationships, positive relationships. If I don't have that, you know, then of course, you know, I'm lacking something I need. I need to cooperate within the framework of a competitive society. In other words, all around me, there seems to be competition. You know, dog eat dog, perhaps. But in that framework, I have to learn how to cooperate. To develop individual initiative, I have to do my own thing in a framework of cooperation. So that when I want to do my thing, I don't want to offend you. I want to cooperate with the kinds of things that you really feel is important. But I want to do my own thing, that kind of thing. And freedom to participate. Perhaps you have power to cause things to move. And you have power to do this and power to do that. Well, I want some of that too. See, I want to help make decisions. If there is anything that prevents me from doing that, then I don't get freedom to participate in the way that I want to. I want to make decisions too. And finally, individualization in the group. I don't think we're mobs. I don't think I regard this as a mob as such. I regard this as a group where I can be my individual self and that I believe that people like yourself will accept me for being my individual self. Okay, but the point that I want to make here is that I want to compare the Indian concept, perhaps, to this other concept. Now, this is not to say that those of us who think like the social work values indicate do not believe in God. I only remember frequent reference to the church nowadays, for instance, as being a social institution. You know, quite often when I was younger, I would go to a church and want to go into the main part of the church and be alone, and I wanted to pray, I wanted to meditate. And this was a country church, and while I was in there, the janitor comes through banging with his pail. and he just didn't understand. So the church apparently was not really doing this kind of thing. You just don't do it, see, in a sense. So you're getting away from the spiritual thing, the church ends up to be a social institution. Family. I think family fits here, but an interesting point here that I noticed is that when you're talking about myself and others, you give no recognition to your family. See? In other words, apparently you can pick up these things if you run away from home and you separate yourself from your family, you can still pick up these things. What I'm saying is that family should be written in there, see, because that's the way it was in the beginning. Now, the environment, see. None of these concepts deal with the environment. It deals with relationships with people, but it doesn't deal with what we're doing to the water and to the air and to the animals and to our natural resources. None of them deal with that. Now, I'm not saying we don't have values in that direction. But I'll tell you, you know, being very aware of what's happening in that reserve case up at Duluth, what are the issues? On the one hand, if they shut down that plant, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs, which is something that has been held as important by the people, the job. And yet, on the other hand, what's happening to the water? Apparently, they're getting so bad now that they're beginning to get bigger and bigger filters. See? And then they kick this judge out, you know, when he was really trying to help. I don't know. See, he was biased. We look back at our values to see what's important. In any case, I've heard frequent references by Indian people that we want to take the best of both worlds, they're saying. And I think that's where I am too. What I'd like to do, as an Indian person, is to respect this whole thing in a very personal way and apply it to my family and to my beliefs and also to my environment. I just love nature. I love animals. And I want that to be some kind of a continuous thing which could be perhaps represented by this mark that spirit, family, and environment is a continuous intermingling. I like that concept because in that I can have my beliefs. I can incorporate them in my family. And when I walk through a park or a woods, I can just sense my belief. See, it is a kind of an integrated kind of thing which, you know, it has become part of me. Over here, I can try to relate to people. But I don't know how far I'd get if I started talking to you about my love for the environment. Only a few of you who have kind of specialized in those areas perhaps would respond that way. And I don't know how far I would get in talking to my religion as such. Maybe a lot of you would like to think that we're all Christian. Well, I am Christian. But on the other hand, you see, there is a belief system here that I think is well worth looking at. Okay. If I were to have all of these values within my life, I think that I'd probably be a fulfilled person. See? I'd have all of you as my friends. See? If I'd have all of these kinds of things in my life connected with my people, I'd really be happy because I'd always know that I could talk to them about this and I could grow up in this thing, could mature myself, and my family could also do that. So what I'm trying to do is to have both of them, the best of both. Now, that's the ideal situation, but now I want to cite to you some things that I've picked up in a book. And I want to tell you what history has done to Indians. Then I'm going to go back to these values to see what that could have meant. In 1611, let's go way back there, 1611, the Jesuits tried to teach Indians Christianity and tried to teach them the French way. See? Were they trying to kind of help them to fulfill themselves? No, this is what they're trying to do. The Franciscans in that same period tried to teach them Christianity and tried to teach them Spanish, see? And tried to form missions, you know, so that missions themselves could be actually their communities. In 1617, the Protestants under King James and that great minister John Eliot came in, and he tried to teach the English and Indian youth in the East Coast. And with that purpose, Dartmouth and Harvard was founded. Now, if Dartmouth and Harvard was founded with that purpose, I'm wondering what Dartmouth and Harvard is doing today. See? In 1787, a great thing was passed. It was called the Northwest Ordinance. They recognized the faith. They said that land and property would be never taken from the Indian people, never be invaded. Laws and justice in humanity would be established. And they would attempt always to preserve peace and friendship. This Northwest Ordinance. Sounds good, pretty good. 1778, first treaty with the Delawares. During that period, people had the idea of manifest destiny. It's a beautiful thought, manifest destiny. Sounds good too. Only thing is, Indian people, when they tried to apply manifest destiny to Indians because they were different. They tried to do all kinds of things to change those Indians. Number one, they tried to exterminate them. Number two, they tried to assimilate them. Then three, turn them into farmers. Four, Christianize them. Five, civilize them. And as a matter of fact, a lot of things happened during that time, but you know, Benjamin Franklin, during that those early years, tried to get some Indian education started. And so he approached some of the leaders and said, well, hey, we'll try to get some education for you. So a number of the Indian leaders got together at that time and wrote a letter to Benjamin Franklin. And here's their letter. It says, "But you who are wise must know that different nations have different conceptions of things. And you will therefore not take it amiss if our ideas of this kind of education happen not to be the same with yours. We have had some experience with it. Several of our young people were formerly brought up at the colleges of the Northern Province. They were instructed with all your sciences. But when they came back, they were bad runners, ignorant of every means of living in the woods, unable to bear either cold or hunger. Neither knew how to build a cabin, take a deer, or kill an enemy, spoke our language imperfectly, were neither fit for hunters, warriors, not counselors. They were totally good for nothing." See, Indian people that were educated came back and with that kind of thing. "We are, however," see, Indians are so generous, see. "Indian, we are, however, not the less obliged by your kind offer. Though we declined accepting it, and to show our grateful sense of it, if the gentlemen of Virginia will send us a dozen of their sons, we will take care of their education, instruct them in all we know, and make men of them." That was an Indian response at that time. In any case, in 1802, Congress acted again to civilize the Indians. And attached onto it $15,000 to civilize them annually, so that every year Congress would appropriate $15,000 to civilize the Indians. Okay, by this time, this Indian business was getting kind of messy. So in 1819, President Monroe said that we have to turn the responsibility of the Indians over to missions. So he tried to do that, see, have them take it over. So this is getting kind of messy. And in 1836, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was set up in the War Department. In 1849, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was shifted over to the Department of Interior. In 1871, end treaties, set up reservations, and establish a general policy of paternalism. In 1890, okay, now here is another thing that happened during that period. Here's a date that I wanted to cite to you for those of you who are interested in alternative education. In 1791, the Senecas requested teachers from George Washington. Several tribes maintained extensive school systems operated and financed by themselves. There were more than 200 Indian schools and academy of the Choctaw Nation in Mississippi and Oklahoma, which sent numerous graduates to Eastern colleges and which flourished until the 1890s. The Cherokee Republic also developed an extensive school system, and estimates of literacy for the 19th century Cherokee run as high as 90%. Cherokee had a higher percentage of better educated persons than the entire white settlement population of Texas or Arkansas. The Cherokee schools taught not only English, but Cherokee as well, using the alphabet invented by Sequoia. The Creeks, Chickasaws, and Seminoles also maintained schools during that period. But in 1890, The federal government acted to close all the Indian schools because they thought that they knew better how to develop Indian education. In 1887, the Dawes Act. The Dawes Act effectively abrogated treaties, divided the land, which at that time was not divided, arbitrarily distributed the land to these same Indian people, and kept them in a wardship status, so they had no decision making to make. They got out of the Indian business, or tried to. They tried to civilize the Indians, relieving the burden to take care of the Indians. And they wanted to effect all these changes in one generation. That's the way the literature reads. In 1891, they're trying to get Indians to attend public school. In 1901, they're trying to get the states to take over this responsibility now. The federal government wants out. And at that time, the states of Idaho, Michigan, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, Oklahoma, Oregon, South Dakota, and Wisconsin came under that kind of move. In 1916, they were trying to establish teacher training in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They stressed trying to make citizens of Indian people and trying to stress vocational education, and also had the same policy of assimilating the Indians, not trying to maintain them as separate. In 1918, they passed another law to limit appropriations for Indians only to those that are fourth degree Indian blood. In 1924, Indians were given citizenship to this country. In 1920, the Miriam Survey, which examined the corruption, intolerance, and also administrative blunders of the federal government. And again, they did this in order to get their facts together to assimilate Indians. 1934, Indian reorganization. In 1934, the establishment of Johnson O'Malley, which is even now a fund which is being used. In 1944, Senate and House were forcing assimilation. 1946, Indian claims, which had the purpose of separating Indians from tribes. But what happened was that as soon as they started going to the Claims Commission, they became knowledgeable about legal things. And with that knowledge, they came back to defend their own position. So the federal government, in trying to separate them and assimilate them, really helped them to understand some of the legal systems. In 1957, the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation program. In 1953, House Concurrent Resolution 108 was established, which moved to terminate the federal status of all Indians. 1961, Udall set up an interior task force on Indian affairs. 1966, the president through the set up a White House task force on Indian affairs. 1967, Indian Resources Development Act. 1968, President Johnson established a National Committee on Indian Organizations. Late 60s, subcommittee, Senator Kennedy conducting Senate hearings. And today, this last year, we had three major things that were happening. One was the Indian Policy Review Commission, Public Law 93-580, was brought into effect on March 5th, 1975. Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act became effective December 4th, 1975, and this is Public Law 93-638. And Title IV of Public Law 92-318, which is the Indian Elementary and Secondary School Assistance Act, became effective in 1972. The regulations were effective in, rules and regs were effective in 1973. In a short review, we go back to our values. Let's be, kind of make believe that we got all these things. Let's make believe that in our families we're fulfilled. and our children are growing up happy, or et cetera, et cetera. Maybe that's not quite the thing to go. Okay, now we're all happy, all right? We're from the beginning. Okay, but now all this period from 1611 to 1950s, let's say these things are happening to us. Christianity, French way, you know, trying to live the French way. President Jackson trying to exterminate us, assimilate us. They don't want our Indian way. They want us to act like non-Indians, make us into farmers, civilize us, because some people thought we were savages or something. Avoid responsibility to give to missions. Of course, now we're being given to the missionaries to do what they want. Close our Indian schools. Abrogate our treaties. Divide land without asking us. Give us a wardship status so we don't have any power. Give us industrial training. Don't send us to college. Send us to go into vocational training. Have states take over so that federal government can get out of their job. Limit the use of appropriations. Separate Indians from tribes. Relocate us. Take us from our land and put us in cities. Terminate all services to us. Now I ask you, do we now have our values? See? Do we have justice? Are we able to fully be responsible for others? See? You could go all the way down here, and you can ask the question, you know, where are we at this particular point? In the state of Minnesota, we have from 11 to 12,000 Indian children in public schools. In the well over 400 districts, about 428 districts, which is the total number of districts in the state of Minnesota, we have 118 school districts with 10 or more Indian children. The Indian dropout rate seems to be quite high. Some districts responsive, sincere, other districts not responsive, resisting to helping Indians. And in every district, of course, you know that you have a school board, you have a superintendent, you have a principal, you have teachers, you have counselors. Okay. In the state of Minnesota, there are no Indian people on school boards, except in, you know, I think there's a couple now. See? In the state of Minnesota, there are no Indian superintendents. There's very few Indian teachers. There's very few Indian counselors. And we have a mass of people that are dropping out of school. Indians generally cannot serve on school boards because of the election processes. They go for the majority. Of course, a little minority group is having a real tough time trying to get on the school board. There's no state policy in the state of Minnesota on Indian education. There are federal programs available for Indian tribes, but local and state laws often do not complement such programs. And there needs to be some kind of policy set so that they can get something done with it. This often leads to a resistance to federal funds by local districts or inappropriate use of those same funds. Then, of course, if you just kind of think of it, there's a local structure operating to serve those kids. There's a state structure operating to care for the rules and the laws of the state. There's a federal structure operating with its particular constraints, laws, rules, and regs. There's a tribal structure operating there. All have to serve the same people. And quite often, we get all crossed up. It's very, very complicated. What I wanted to suggest today was that in the light of a very complex organization, like the State Department of Education, as well as all these other organizations, We have a problem to maintain our own selves, you know, as we really are, as a people. Now, I find myself in the middle, kind of. On the one hand, I'm a human being. On the other hand, I'm part of the system. See? So quite often, I try to break out of it. And quite often, at those times, I resort to my friend that I take along with me almost always. I brought him along tonight, too. I want to introduce him to you. His name is Winnie Bujou. How many of you have heard of Winnie Bujou? Okay. Now, Winnie Bujou, I just want to just confide it. By the way, I'm not supposed to talk about him in the warm air. So when it's cold, that's when I can talk about him. See? It's cold tonight. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. Winnie Bujou is like a legendary hero. He is like a giant, you know. He can do a lot of things, like physical things. He's magic. He can do magic things. He is wise. He can do a number of things because he has such a good mind. But on the other hand, he's stupid. He constantly gets into trouble. See? He just constantly gets into trouble. So, you know, I thought that one of the things that I have Winnie Bujou tendencies. See? That's kind of dangerous. Because on the one hand, well, of course, on the one hand, Winnie Bujou knows about the Indian values, because he is Indian. See? And he will actually know about these kinds of things in operation of some of the stuff that he does. On the other hand, if he's turned loose in the State Department, I was thinking, you know, man, he'd get into all kinds of trouble. I want to share him with you because it's just kind of fun. See? Okay. First story. One day, Winnie Bujou was walking in the woods. He's carrying a rifle, and he was going to hunt some deer. See? Come walking along and so forth. Guess who he runs into? He runs into the Bureau of Indian Affairs Forest Supervisor. See? Of course, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Forest Supervisor takes one look at him and he says, "Hey, Indians can't hunt here." Whereupon Winnie Bujou beats him up, ties him to a tree, shaves off all his head, hair on his head, and leaves him there for 3 days until his pants are baggy. That's why today we have BIA 4 supervisors with bald heads and baggy pants. You know Winnie Bujou is here. But I want to tell you, Winnie Bujou went out one day, and he was walking along a lake. And one day he was really hungry. He was really, you know how it is to be hungry. You know, you know your saliva glands are just kind of just ready to operate and everything else, and there's nothing there. And then your stomach starts hurting. You know, you're really hungry. And he was really having difficulty because there was no game. And so he was looking around every place for game. And there was none around. He usually could get a rabbit, Waboose, or he could pick up a deer someplace. But no go. This day, there just didn't seem to be anything. And then he was walking along this lake, and way out in the lake, he saw some ducks way out there. Of course, Winnie Bujou doesn't have a boat. And he doesn't have any kind of thing to shoot them, and even so, you know, they're so far out there, he'd miss anyway. You know, what's the use? So what does he do? He uses his mind. Winnie Bujou goes and picks up a hollow log and picks up a stick and ends up start pounding it. Hey, that sounds pretty good. Yeah. And picks up a hollow log and picks up a stick and ends up start pounding it. Yeah. See? Hey, that sounds pretty good. Yeah. he starts pounding this hollow log, see, just like that. And then he starts singing, you know, he starts singing just like, and then the sound kind of booms out through the air, bouncing along the waves and everything. And way out in the water, here are these dumb ducks, you know. And what they were doing was tipping up and, you know, all the stupid things ducks do, you know. You know, and some of them were long necks and some of them were kind of curled up, you know. They really looked kind of dumb, you know, really. And it reminded me of people, you know. Some people go like that, you know, and some long necks and stuff like that, you know. But in any case, one of them said, as was is usually the case, somebody's always about to say it, "Hey, do you hear something?" Said, and the other ducks come up and flip off a drop of water. And, "No, I don't hear anything." And he said, "Don't you hear any drums?" Say, "Yeah, I think we do." "Yeah, but I didn't see anything that there wasn't a powwow around, was there? You know, I didn't know that. Maybe we ought to investigate." So they kind of zipped them closer and closer. Here, you know, Winnie Bouge is pounding on this log, and he was just going to look out of the corner of his eye at these things and keep pounding. "Come on, you stupid ducks." And he was talking in Indian, see? He's talking in Indian, so they wouldn't know, see? Come on, you stupid ducks. You come to a big feast, you know, that kind of thing, and so forth. So stupid ducks do come. And, you know, if you know the drum, when you hear it, see? God, you know, it just kind of grips you, see? And man, you start going, you know? You just can't help it, see? These stupid ducks start going like that. And of course, they're flat-footed, see? And you ever try to dance flat-footed, you know, like so? Dancing like a bunch of women, see? In any case, they come up on a shore, and he started to dance like this, and then he directs them. He says, "Now we're going to be dancing in a circle. And then we're going to have a surprise." See? So he starts pounding this way, and he's got all these stupid ducks going around him. See? Finally, he gets up, and he takes his log, and he keeps beating it, and he moves toward his wigwam. You know, there's magically a wigwam right by the shoreline there. See? So he goes to the wigwam and goes right inside. And wigwams are round. See, they're pitched like so, see? This is the Chippewa kind of version of the house, see? And they're covered with all kinds of stuff, and they're really nice and cozy in there, little hole in the middle, kind of. So he gets in there, and he goes around, and these dumb ducks are starting dancing around, you know, right behind him in single file, all around. He kind of throws a flap shut, and he didn't quite get it shut, but he just kept dancing around. And then he says, in Indian, he says, "Now you stupid ducks are going to be one more thing," he says. "Before we have the feast, there's going to be a surprise." See? And so he said, "All of you will close your eyes and dance." See? So they all close their eyes. So while they all close their eyes, he went around to each one of them and he twisted their necks so that, you know, he was really going to really have a dinner. See? So in the process, one of the ducks, you know, one of the last ducks, there was only one left, he opened his eyes, see, and he saw what was happening. And you know what ducks will do. They go, "Wah!" And he hit the top of the wigwam. And he went over and hit the side of the wigwam. He was trying to get out of there, see. And of course, Winnie Bouge didn't want him to escape. So he lunged at him, and he couldn't get him. And finally, he saw that little hole left. And he dove for the little hole, and in the process, Winnie Bouge kicked him really hard with his foot. Well, now today we have a duck in the northern wilds called a shingebis. If you look at the shingebis, you will see Winnie Boujou's foot on the back, on his back. That's a Winnie Boujou story. And in the process, what we have done is, you know, if I were in my own home and I had a number of kids around, I would begin telling them Winnie Boujou stories in the winter nights. And one of the things that I would want to do is to be very close to these people. You know, I'd look at them straight and I'd make sure that they're just kind of picking up these signals. And these signals. And these signals are ones of communication and sharing, and the kinds of things that I need to have in order for me to have my family, so to speak. See? In other words, I had a feeling today too at the supper tonight. We had a family there. I kind of felt it. Those students who ate with us were all sitting in a circle, so to speak, and in the process of our discussion, I felt closer to them, and that was that kind of family thing. But in the process too, I suddenly feel that I can tell you my belief. See, I want to share another thing with you. You know, I'm 4/4 Chippewa, if that makes any difference to you. See, but what I was trying to find my own heritage, too. See, because at the age of 9, I was taken out of the reservation and put in a Norwegian home. See? But psychologists have said that already at the age of 5, you have already got your personality. See? I was there until I was 9, and I was put into this home. Well, it was kind of a foster placement. And in the process of it, then I went through all kinds of adventures, of course. And in the process, then I got into some kind of cultural. I run away from home and trying to find myself and, you know, that kind of thing. And finally did find myself, although there was a real struggle. And another thing that I did, while I was in those days, I went to college. I went to Luther College. Well, don't look at me like that. No. But then I began to appreciate some of the backgrounds of these various people. See? But when I come back to these Indian things of mine, I went back to Flambeau. Lac du Flambeau is where I'm from. Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin, that's near Minocqua. If you don't know where that is, that's near Woodruff. If you don't know where that is, that's near, well, you know, Flambeau is in northern Wisconsin, near Ironwood, Eagle River, and that goes there. Beautiful lakes out there. Okay. So I went back there and, you know, I found my name. Now, we have a clan system that I want to share with you about, and it just... In that clan system are 5 clans. Oh, there's a story along with that. It seems to be in the beginning. There were some spirits that came from the east. There were 6 spirits. And these 6 spirits came over the land, see. And they looked down at the Anishinaabe. The Anishinaabe means people. And of course, they were so powerful that they had to shield themselves so that they don't look at those individuals. And in the process, then, one of them did. And then the sixth one was kicked back into the sea, and the five stayed to be the clans. And these are the clans. When I was a small baby, when I was perhaps about 3 years old, I was given two names. One name came from Martins. And the other one came from the loon. I didn't know that. But when I went back to find my name, they could give me only one name. And my name is Shawanibanes. This pertains to a bird from the south. See? Now, this is actually a protector. And as it was interpreted to me, this is what it means. This bird is going to protect you all your life because you have been given that power now. The bird can be like a cloud that comes over. It's cloudy now. Therefore, you know, it's my protector. You think of the thunderbird, there's power. Up in Duluth, I saw the most beautiful northern lights that I've ever seen. And I went out, it's scary, you know, it's really, really beautiful. And I went up there and I saw a huge bird, shimmering feathers all the way down like this, right to a point, right up here. And it spread way out. And I remembered my name. Now, the story that goes along with that is that I wanted to ask people my name. See? And so I asked a number of the local yokels around there, hey, what's my name? Oh, they thought that that was an interesting question, so they sat down and pulled out a bottle of beer, and then we started to try to remember things. Then as we got to be a little sociable, thinking about different points of my name, then somebody pulled out that record player, and then we had those drums again, see? So we got the drums going, see? We were drinking a little beer a little bit and talking and trying to remember some of those things which were in my past. Here this old woman comes zooming along on a dirt road in the village, and she started dancing around right down the road. She said, well, what's going up? And I said, we're trying to think of the name. And so she come and joined us. A car went by. They waved. We waved back. They stopped about just a few yards up, and they backed up, and they pulled in. It kept on going like that for the next hour. Everybody is coming and stopping and looking and then getting into the process of finding my name. Do you realize that before the whole thing was over, we had about 150 people, you know, just all clustered around talking and drinking beer and remembering names? Isn't that great? Out of this, I got my name. And out of this, I ended up finding some of my background. And suddenly I have a real new insight. Now, locally, I just want to show you, tell you a little of my difficulties. There are some Christian concepts that I have that are very, very close to me. I'm a Christian, like I said. But now, what do I do? Do I go over to the Christian thing and do the whole thing? Or do I go over to the Indian thing and do that thing? I had to make that decision for my dad. we went the Indian thing. Isn't there a way, some way, that you can think of God in many ways? See? Doesn't Scripture say that, you know, there isn't no one that has seen God, not one? Isn't there many windows that you can see spiritual reality? We say in Christian, among our Christians, that, you know, only through Christ can you be saved. Then in the process, we end up thinking only about certain kinds of things that are associated with that kind of concept. And I'm trying to take that concept and talk to anybody over in this other reality, and I'm having all kinds of problems. See? Now what do I do? Do I give up my family? Do I give up my heritage? Do I jump into this other thing and go to church? See? And I go to church and I find, you know, a reaching within me. I'm reaching for something constantly. I need the total me in there, see? And what I'm finding is a lot of form. And I don't even get to know the people. Family, it's just my immediate nuclear family, but not the way I really like it. And the Indian community involved everybody over here. Isn't there a way that we can look at our communities and see that happening in our communities? Somebody suggested to me that I ought to think of a Chippewa Christ. Wow, you know, how the deuce am I supposed to do that? See? I really struggle with the two different kinds of concepts. I feel I'm a responsible person. But I think that there are thousands who can't even talk about the spiritual realm because people are shoving a particular idea at them and won't give them an education and a viewpoint as to what life is all about. And I'm struggling right in the middle. And one of the things that I hoped to do was to find it myself. And then Jeremiah says, if you search for it with all your heart, you'll find it. See? And frequently, scriptures are leading me to really search for it, really look for it. See? It's not only trying to be safe, you know, to be saved and to be safe. I got my whole life ahead of me, and I'm surrounded by people and adventures and exciting things and life. And people in the Christian churches nowadays, man, are they, you know, sad. Really, I don't know what to do over here, see? I put on my establishment stuff, see? I try to get in with it. I write furious notes, see? Maybe there's some magic spirits coming through to me now. I want it bad. I don't get it. See? Sometimes the ministers are not prepared. I get the feeling sometimes they don't pray about the thing. They're not spiritual enough. Whereas when that medicine man came with his drum and he laid it out, he says, I'm glad that I'm here. I'm glad that all of you are here. All of you are blessed. This song that I'm going to sing will hold all of us together because I know, because that has the power to do it. And those old Indian people cried. See? And I went to Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Minneapolis with my mother, trying to go the Christian way again. People stared at us. We didn't fit in. See? That kind of thing. I'm struggling constantly with this kind of thing. Then I'm pushed into this new education thing. I don't know how long I'll last as a person in those areas. I don't know how long I'm going to be in that State Department of Education. I would like to help people to move towards some new laws. I'm not saying that we should destroy the old ones. I am confident that, you know, if I could talk to a number of you, we could get together and maybe lobby together, maybe. Maybe we can try to change those guys' minds a little bit and get some laws going. State board, they don't even know Indians. Maybe with your help, we can start talking to them and convincing them of a new policy, helping them to do it some way, encouraging them. Is there any hope for an individual or a small group that have so many concerns that Indian people have? Do we have to be entirely separate in order to find ourselves? Do we have to be destroyed before people realize that what you're destroying is yourself? See? Because when these things happen to Indian people in systems, they're going to be happening to systems all over and to individuals and so forth. When a treaty is abrogated, when something is broken up there in a system, if we haven't gotten down to the cause of it, I don't know where guys like I am going to end up. Oh, I know one thing, you know. I hope I, you know, am going to be getting as much help in that last trip as my dad got. See? Now, Red in Northfield now, what am I supposed to do? To prepare myself for death, what do? I go over here and ask the local cemetery association, hey, can you sell me this piece of land? How many friends, you know, will really surround me if I would go over here and, you know, be buried there? You know, that kind of thing. Isn't it possible for people in Northfield and at St. Olaf and so forth and so on to do this Indian thing together? You know, I feel it is. And it is with that hope that I try to share these kinds of ideas, and I like to think that that being personal with you, as well as telling you frankly, I'm frustrated with the system, and I'm going to do my darndest to try to change it. Indian people and non-Indian people alike are not knowing the issues enough. And I think we should do some research projects to help get that knowledge out a little better. See? Because I think what we're talking about now is affecting all of us. And I really appreciated sharing some of these thoughts with you, and hope that it can lead you to maybe give me a call sometime. Maybe we'll get a project going. I was hopeful that that some students might be interested in a little research, because we need it. We need people that think it through and help us find some of these answers, you know, as such. So this is the end of my statement. I've really appreciated being here with you and to sharing with this stuff with you. And I'd be very pleased to talk to you now, just informally. And apparently, is there a coffee shop here afterward too? Yeah. I'll be glad to go over there if some of you would like to talk a little bit more about it and things of your interest. So now I'll open for general kinds of questions, and I'll be glad to talk. Yeah?
What do you do? You're with the State Department of Education.
Right. What do I do? to listen. That's why I'm saying, you know, if just an hour and a half, it's very difficult to just really spell this whole thing out. It's very difficult. And what I wanted to do is tie into the values and to suggest to you what systems are kind of like. This is kind of my job, which relates specifically. And of course, we have about 33 that I'm a supervisor to about 33 people, you know, in three regions. And we have offices in Duluth and Bemidji and in St. Paul. And I get involved in human relations kinds of things within the system, and civil rights, and alternative schools. I've been out to them and trying to help develop those kinds of ideas. Anything else that involves Indian education, I'm right there. See, so this kind of gives you a general idea. I hope that it's not adequate, I know, but I hope it helps you a little bit. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
How do you view alternative schools that are developing in certain areas run by Indians in the traditional or so-called traditional Indian fashion, such as Red Schoolhouse in St. Paul?
Well, there are perhaps three ways in which we can have alternative schools in the state of Minnesota. One way is to have a school within a school, and such as is out at Onamia. There, you know, we were having a school separate, in a separate building at that time, and we were violating civil rights, so we put it a school within a school. Okay. Another way is that if we get the legislators to set up a separate district, that is to say, you know, they can vote a separate district for the school, and then they have their own district. An example of that is a Pine Point Elementary School. See, that's the second kind of way. The third kind of way is that it is possible to have a private school, such as a Red Schoolhouse and such as other kinds of arrangements. But with it, you don't get public funds, or at least you don't get state funds. So you're constantly hassling the budget as such. Now, state law does not allow us in the State Department to help schools like the Red Schoolhouse as much as I think we should. State law does not allow that. I personally feel, as I've shared with some of you, that there should be an alternative to a school system if the school system is not going to be able to do the job. And I also feel very close with tribes in their self-determination that they should design their own programs. But in these private schools, as far as a separate school like Red Schoolhouse, I think that this should be one of the alternatives that should be developed and continued. Now, I am officially not able to help them, but unofficially, maybe I can assist and give them information, that type of thing, you know, as such. But I am for that kind of thing, and they do have a very, very definitely a cultural emphasis in that school. Yeah, yeah.
Is Title IV cut off to, like, the private schools then, or the federal funds in that?
No, Title IV is a supplementary fund, federal fund, that should be used in public schools. See, and there's Part A, Part B, and Part C. Part A is the Elementary and Secondary School Assistance Act for Indians. See, Part B relates to maybe private schools and other kinds of arrangements. Part C talks about adult education. And for each of them, the law is very specific, and then under it, there's some rules and regs that are very specific, and so in the rules and regs tells you how to apply. See, and so in local districts, Title IV is a supplementary fund. That means that the general education of the Indian children in that school district have to be provided by that school with the present funds. But the extra kinds of things, related to cultural programs and so forth could be provided by Title IV. Now, there's a process that those Indian communities have to go through. They have to form their own parent groups. They have to have a public hearing. They have to go to a number of needs assessments and a whole number of things, which you'd be really surprised how complicated that gets. But Title IV is very significant in meeting the educational needs in school districts today, public schools. Well, there was a number of things that I had felt, you know, initially. Now, for one thing, I think this is kind of a forum right now, see, kind of, that some things can be done. If St. Olaf and Gustavus and Luther and, you know, all these schools like that would provide some opportunity within it, you know, within the program, set some priorities or something, so that this kind of learning can happen. Then, you see, you know, I'm struggling with this Christian thing all by myself, see? Okay, now I want to talk to somebody. I want to talk to a pastor, see? Well, the pastor doesn't know anything about this, you know, the struggle. He doesn't know what to say, and he ends up to be kind of apologetic, in a sense. And he's very sincere, and I really, you know, very sincere about him too, you know, I just don't know what to do. But if we can get the thinking going, see, you know, obviously a lot of us believe in things. If we can clarify this, so establish forums. Secondly, you know, from my knowledge of it, I haven't seen very much effectiveness done with programs of this nature in at Luther. They've got nothing. St. Olaf has something, you know. Well, not much, but something, you know. You know, and that's really good. But they should have more of this. An interesting thing, they should connect with the community some way. In St. Olaf, they should connect with the Winnebagoes, because they're in this area. They should connect with the Sioux people. They're in this area. Classes could be set up in such a way so that a group of students could go over to Flambeau, see, on a field trip. You should try some of this kind of stuff and write papers on it. In urban areas, we have, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, we have about 92, at the last count, 92 Indian organizations in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Okay, we have a massive need for a community organization. Okay, this is a tremendous idea for a student to go over there and begin to analyze that situation, come up with some answers. So students themselves can get involved in this kind of process. In order for this to happen, perhaps there needs to be somebody who has the money to lay out some ways that that can happen. And I really am excited about the possibility of St. Olaf doing something like this. Now, I'm not saying that go that far, but at least, you know, there's a number of things that can really happen. Yeah.
Yeah. How about tying in with NIEA and some of their programs they have with reviewing of literature and things like that that St. Olaf can be involved with? Give them some of the telephone numbers from NIEA, which is Native National Indian Educators Association in St. Paul.
A lot of you are going to be teachers. Perhaps, you know, maybe your goal is to be a teacher. Hey, what if you had a number of Indian kids in your classroom? Are you ready then to serve them? Will you want to know a little bit about the curriculum that you're going to use? Will you want to be a little sensitive to, you know, now how do you do that? And you don't want to lose the kids, they don't want to drop them out. So now what do? How do you relate to them? You think you should bone up a little bit upon this background a little bit? Shouldn't you use some certain methods, see, And shouldn't they be kind of Indian methods? These aren't exciting things, you know. They're not kind of scary things. In my mind, they're exciting things. Because a teacher loves kids and devotes the life to the kids, you know. And I think that that's the kind of thing that, you know, can really happen, you know. You get those projects going and all your kids, you know, I went over to Northfield High School. A sea of blonde hair and blue eyes. So maybe what you're going to do is prepare yourself to go to Northfield High School to teach. See? But it may be that you're going to be in a different school system with all different kinds of people. And in my mind, what you ought to do is kind of get yourself prepared for that. If there's Indian kids in your classroom, I think that there are some things you can do. In Indian education nowadays, I think there's a lot of things happening. Federal monies are being available for certain programs. You ought to explore it. So, you know, this is kind of to your question. Other questions? Well, Winnie Bujo was walking in his woods. He's kind of hungry. He's always hungry, you know. I don't know what's the matter with him. But as he walked in the woods, he couldn't find any meat, any place. So he saw this bear. Of course, the bear is one of the clan names. And you can't kill a bear. But you know, Winnie Bujo was quite hungry anyway. So he looked around. Guess what he did? He killed a bear. Dressed them out, hung the meat up above the fire. Nice crackling fire. The juices dropped out, like that. And the smell of that meat. Oh man, this is gonna really taste good. Really taste good, this bear meat. And so he sat down and he was going to turn it over a little bit and so forth. Suddenly, he heard whispering. Way back in this direction, whispering. It bothered him, really. So he went back there, and he couldn't find anybody, so he come back and sat down again. He watched that. Man, that meat was looking better all the time. He's getting really hungry, so he's just going to sample again, and he heard that whispering again. So he went all the way back in there, and guess what it was? It was two trees, see? Two birch trees that were kind of leaning together like this. And in the wind, they were kind of squeaking together, see, kind of like that. And then, oh boy, he was relieved. So he came back and he said, oh, that's just a tree. It starts squeaking again. It still bothered him, see, because he had killed a bear, and that's really bad, see. So he went over there and he climbed up the tree and he stuck his leg down in between the two trees. That sure stopped the squeaking. But you know what happened? He got stuck up there. He couldn't get his dumb leg out of there, see? And while he was trying to pull out, some wolves came by and consumed the meat, see? There was his meat, and that was it, see? He finally got down, and he was so mad that he took a bunch of brush that he could collect, and he went over there, and he punished those trees. Whack, 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 whack. Now, to this day, if you observe, birch trees have little black markings all up and down. It's Winnie Bujo.